This is Black Agenda Radio, a weekly hour of African-American political thought and action.
Welcome to the radio magazine that brings you news, analysis, and commentary from a black left perspective. I'm Glenn Ford, along with my co-host, Nellie Bailey. Coming up, President Obama hosts a bunch of bankers for his conference on housing, but fails to invite anybody representing community groups, consumers, or tenants. And Dr. Tony Montero discusses our life and death struggle with the vampire economy.
But first, the long-suffering black residents of New Orleans finally scored a victory last week. A court ruled that a federal program to help rebuild housing damaged by Hurricane Katrina was racially discriminatory. The case was argued by the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund. Attorney Damon Hewitt explains.
Hurricanes Katrina and Rita in 2005, Louisiana and New Orleans in particular were in tremendous need. People lost their homes and everything they had, including my own parents. I was born and raised in New Orleans myself. In order to respond to this need, the United States Congress created a disaster recovery program to provide money to storm-affected states and areas to allow for the rebuilding of those areas. Using this money, $11.3 billion of this money, the state of Louisiana created what was called the Road Home Program. Unfortunately, for many black homeowners, the Road Home Program was a road to nowhere. The program bases its grant formula on one of two values, either the pre-storm value of a person's home or the cost to actually repair the damage, whichever is lower. It turns out that most African-American homeowners had their grants based upon the pre-storm value of their homes, which by definition means they had insufficient funds to rebuild. And this led to serious racial disparities in terms of which neighborhoods were actually able to rebuild and recover.
The pre-storm value of the home would be based upon market forces, and market forces are based upon valuations that have everything to do with race. That is, black neighborhoods are undervalued, and therefore black properties are undervalued as well.
Exactly. And the pre-storm value criterion is an artificial criterion because it's based upon market forces that have nothing to do with the actual damage sustained or the cost to repair. In fact, we know that there are nearly identical homes of very similar, if not identical, construction in majority black neighborhoods and majority white neighborhoods. And even though the homes are pretty much the same, even though the homes sustain the same amount of damage, and even though they cost almost exactly the same to repair, the homes in majority white neighborhoods have a higher market value. So those individuals are more likely to have sufficient funds to rebuild, while African-American homeowners are severely disadvantaged.
We could take this principle much further. For example, when governments use eminent domain to condemn properties to make a road, if the property owners are compensated based on the value of the property, you might find that as soon as one crosses the railroad tracks, all of a sudden the compensation is a lot lower because the black neighborhood is devalued.
Right. There are a number of concepts, and one of the real problems is how market value is determined. Once you cross the street into a different neighborhood or go down the street just a few blocks, that's essentially a different subset of the market. It's a completely artificial criterion, and to build a recovery program based upon market values essentially ensures that we will replicate existing inequalities and discrimination, and that's what a federal grant program simply cannot do.
Now, hadn't this result been predictable from the start? Hadn't housing advocates warned about this?
The result was predictable from the start. Our clients, the Greater New Orleans Fair Housing Action Center and also the National Fair Housing Alliance, a national organization, notified the Louisiana agencies who designed this program that there was a flaw, a problem, which would be a fatal flaw over time. And it wasn't until about 2008 that data was available indicating that their predictions were accurate, that this program severely disadvantages black homeowners.
Your clients had wanted a freeze on spending for that road home program. How did that come out in the ruling?
Well, there were two rulings by the Federal District Court in Washington, D.C. In the first ruling, the court found that the program was likely discriminatory, and he lamented the fact, the judge did, that the program seemed to discriminate against African-American homeowners. However, the court felt that he could not issue any relief or order any relief for individuals who had already received a discriminatory grant. So he declined to freeze funds that would essentially be surplus funds that could be used to pay out a remedy in this case. But in a subsequent order issued earlier this week, the judge determined that, in fact, the state should be barred from using a discriminatory formula to issue any further grants or any additional grants. So that's a victory for those who have yet to receive their grant awards. The plaintiffs have appealed the portion of the order that pertains to the prior grant awards, and we're hopeful that we will prevail in the D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals.
So where do we go from here?
Well, on the legal front, again, we are appealing the portion of the order that denies relief to those who have already received grants. We're asking for the D.C. Circuit, the Court of Appeals, to hear that appeal on an expedited basis, because every day that goes by means that there's less and less, fewer and fewer dollars available to actually help these individuals rebuild. And many of them are in dire straits now, 5 years after Hurricane Katrina first ravaged New Orleans on the Gulf Coast. Second, the state has appealed the ruling that prohibits it from granting discriminatory grants in the future. It's nearly incomprehensible why a state that's already shot its own citizens in the foot would appeal an order that's designed to bring them justice, but that appeal will likely be heard by the Court of Appeals as well. So the legal battle continues, and the plaintiffs will be right there in the Legal Defense Fund, and its allies will be right there fighting all the way.
I guess we can assume that you're seeking to establish a precedent so that these kinds of discriminatory formulas aren't imposed in the future.
It's important to understand that a disaster can strike the Gulf Coast again. It can strike any of the coasts or any area in this country. A natural or man-made disaster could strike. And it's important that we set a precedent here that when disaster does strike, that the government doesn't come behind that disaster and make things worse. August 29th of 2010 marks 5 years since Hurricane Katrina made landfall in South Louisiana. And there are still people who are in need. There are still people who are displaced, tens of thousands of them. And there are still people who are bitter and angry. But most importantly, there are people who are still waiting for a fair shake from their government, the government that was supposed to help them at the state and federal level. We know that there were prior administrations that made decisions that lead to some of the disparities that we see in Louisiana's disaster recovery, in particular its Road Home program. But we know that there are people in place in the state and federal government who can make this right if they wanted to right now. And we call upon their consciousness. We call upon these individuals to do the right thing here and to help people who have been displaced for so long, who have been struggling for nearly 5 years, to finally make that long road home and rebuild their homes and rebuild their communities.
That was Attorney Damon Hewitt of the NAACP Legal Defense and Educational Fund.
There is no economic recovery in sight for working people, certainly not for Black Americans. Yet Wall Street is riding high, flush with the $12 to $14 trillion doled out to the banks by the Obama administration. Anthony Montero is a professor of African American Studies at Temple University in Philadelphia and a frequent contributor to the Black Agenda Report. He has this analysis.
What we have is two economies, a vampire economy that is structured around banks, investment houses, hedge funds, large insurance companies, money markets, and the derivatives that they produce. Most of this economy is centered in the United States on Wall Street, but also in London and other financial centers around the world. But Wall Street and London are the main centers. This vampire economy and the derivatives that it produces, and I would emphasize that the only thing that it produces are derivatives and these vast profits from the sale and trading in the derivatives. This economy is parasitic upon the economy that produces things, and the economy of over 90% of the people in this country. The vampire economy sucks the lifeblood of the real economy and is dependent upon the real economy for its life. The other thing about it, when the vampire economy gets in trouble, the real economy, through the monies of taxpayers and working people, is used to bail out the vampire economy, further intensifying the blood-sucking of the vampire economy. At this point, the vampire economy has been saved from complete collapse, but the real economy is still on the verge of complete collapse. In other words, Wall Street has been saved, and the future of Main Street is still uncertain.
But this sounds like a life and death struggle. How long can the real economy withstand that vampire-like behavior, that parasitical relationship with the Wall Street economy?
You know, Glenn, you put it accurately. It is a life and death struggle, and it is a life and death struggle between these two economies. Really, it is a manifestation of the 21st century class struggle, to put it in those terms, that the concentration of wealth is greater than ever before, and it is concentrated overwhelmingly on Wall Street and in these large banks and investment houses, insurance companies, hedge funds, money markets, and so on. It is a life and death struggle as I see it. The other thing that I think we have to consider is that we are as close as we have ever been in the history of this country towards a complete collapse of the economy, of the free market capitalist economy. Wall Street, for the moment, is out of the woods. Main Street is still on the verge of total collapse. I think the situation is far more severe than even during the time of the Great Depression. Now, a lot of people will say, well, are you predicting a double dip recession? I'm predicting something worse than a double dip recession. I'm predicting a long period of stagnation and decline in the economy and in the society. Wall Street and the banks and the investment houses and so on will be profitable, but we will be looking at national rates of anywhere from 12 to 15, 16% and African-American unemployment over 25% for prolonged periods of time.
When black people talk about our traditional, if that is the correct word, unemployment rate of twice as high as the white rate, and that's been true for the last 40 years, we're treated often as making a special pleading. But you seem to be saying in your article that the plight of black workers in this country is at the root of the problem, and there is no larger solution without dealing with that problem.
Yes, it is part of the foundation of the crisis. It is a critical part of the foundation of the crisis, and that has been for the entire 20th century. In other words, if you take the 21st century, 40 million African Americans, most of whom are on the margins of the economy. And by the margins, what I'm saying is that black people in this crisis have witnessed the greatest transfer of wealth from their families and from their communities than we have seen since slavery. Black people are looking at levels of poverty and near poverty that are unimaginable, for whom that would only have been imaginable 100 years ago. We are being thrown back as a people to a period, something like the late 19th century. Racism is a critical part of the crisis of American capitalism. That's what I'm trying to say.
Is this something that many of the left liberal economists, who we usually count as our friends, understand at a fundamental level?
Yes, they are our friends, but they do not understand that. And that is why I think that an important part of black or African-American discourse has to be economic. You know, we've talked about everything from hip-hop to race, to sexuality, to gender. But if you notice, most black public intellectuals, almost all of them, hardly ever mention the economy, when the economy is what is the most important aspect of the crisis that African-Americans are facing. You know, I said in the article that African-Americans are buffeted by the plunderous activity of finance capital and structural racism. That is a double bind, a double crisis that we face.
How does one reform or regulate an animal such as this Wall Street vampire economy that has no intention of investing in productive enterprise,
that resists
at every step of the way and controls so many levers of government? How can we even be speaking of regulation?
Well, the only reforms that will begin to address this problem are radical reforms. Joseph Stiglitz makes a step in the direction of radical reforms, what would be considered radical reforms within the framework of the American political system, which itself is a big problem. He calls for a social market economy, something like what is found in Sweden or other European countries. But liberal reforms that prop up the Anglo-American laissez-faire model of capitalism, where banks are in control of the politics and the economy, those types of reforms will not address the depth of the problems that we face. I think we have moved beyond liberal reforms. In fact, most of what we call liberals are today neoliberals, which is another way of talking about a new form of conservatism.
So what should we be proposing as people of the left?
See, I think the social market economy is an important transitionary step. A social market economy that looks something like or resembles a 21st century New Deal, but much bolder than Franklin Roosevelt implemented. A WPA program, a Work Projects Administration program, a guaranteed income, a living wage, taking over many of the major banks, nationalizing them, and not just giving them money and letting them do their thing, but taking them over and running them in the interest of rebuilding industry, infrastructure, and so on. But that even is not enough, because I think the next stage, and we have to look at stages of answering this problem, because we didn't get into it overnight. We're not going to come out of it overnight. The next stage is what I call a socialist market economy, something like what the Venezuelans, the Chinese, and the Cubans talk about at this point. But finally, we have to look towards an advanced 21st century form of socialism, learning from correcting many of the mistakes made in the socialist countries that collapsed in the 1990s. But we have to think in these large terms. We have to think in historic terms. We have to think in bold terms. The economic system that we're living with is in ruins, in many ways on the verge of collapse. We are not out of the woods. We might not experience a double-dip recession. we might experience something worse than a double dip inflation, and that would be several decades of stagnation with 10-15% unemployment nationally and 25-30% unemployment rates among African Americans. We could, if we do not resolve this problem on terms that meet the needs of ordinary people, face a social and cultural dark ages, violence, irrationality, and the threat of the rise of authoritarian forms of government similar to what we saw in Germany and Italy and Japan in the 1930s. And of course, there are those who are reckless enough to think that they can resolve the crisis of capitalism in this country through repression at home and war overseas. That would not serve our interests. We should want a broad discussion of the economy, of the crisis of the economy, and the way forward. I think that the discussion of socialism, of a social market economy, of a socialist market economy, have to be thrown into the mix. The details of what each of these stages of economic reconstruction would mean can be filled in. But certainly, the emphasis would not be upon profits, it would be upon people. Now, that does not mean that enterprises and corporations should not be profitable, but the profit motive must not obscure the human needs of the people of this country, and that is housing, jobs, education, a cultural life that's decent, a real healthcare system that meets the needs of the people. This is what we have to put on the table.
Well, clearly, at every stage, one would have to go tooth and nail with Wall Street, with finance capital, which you seem to be saying is the fundamental problem. On the black side, in terms of the black polity, what level of understanding of this problem do you think exists?
I think it is very low, and that's part of our problem. The political and intellectual level of the American people is very low at this point. The tragedy is that African Americans, who have produced such stellar leadership over our history in this country, now do not have a leadership that measures up to the crisis that we face. This is a tragedy. The fact that most of the elite intellectuals are tied up with a form of neoliberalism, this conservative thinking. They support, in one or another way, the American model of capitalism. They support American empire. They support the class stratification system. Many of them see the black poor as a problem. Then we have obscurantist political leaders and religious leaders. We are in a situation worse than what W.E.B. Du Bois was looking at in 1948 when he said that the talented tenth, his metaphor for the black leadership class, had failed, had become consumed in universal selfishness. He called for, as an alternative, a guiding 100th. You know, we are going to have to work, at least our generation, and perhaps our final contribution to the next generations will be to help to find and mold that guiding 100th that will be the next generation's leadership of black people. And Glenn, that is why I have such admiration for the work that you do and the work of your colleagues at the Black Agenda Report, because who will speak the truth? You know, I reviewed one book for the Black Agenda Report by the young scholar Pinnell Josephs entitled Bright Nights, Dark Days, From Black Power to Barack Obama. And I sent you another review called From Du Bois to Obama by a scholar from Colgate University, Charles Pete Banahalli. And one of the things that I've seen in both of them is that as political text, they fail. As scholarship, they fail. But more than that, they distort the truth. In fact, I would even go further. They attack the truth. And in attacking the truth, they obscure the path forward in the creation of a 21st century black leadership class. The masses of our people demand, they want a reliable, consistent black leadership that stands upon the truth and puts the interests of the people ahead of personal advancement. This is really a critical time.
So what happens when one's leadership class is revealed as a misleadership class? What happens to a people?
Well, there are any number of outcomes. One thing is that a people without the type of secular leadership that was exemplified by W.E.B. Du Bois, Fannie Lou Hamer, Ida B. Wells, Barnett, Paul Robeson, you know, that's the main trend of black leadership: selfless, secular, truth-seeking, rational, scientific leadership. Without that, the people retreat into obscurantist religion, into cults, into forms of ethnic mythology. You know, a lot of this, what today we call Afrocentrism, extreme Afrocentrism, we are divine, other people are demons or devils. You know, this type of thing occurs when there is not leadership. And again, I emphasize secular, you know. And by secular, I don't mean that you can't be religious. But when you lead the people, your religion is not what you lead with. Your religion is what guides your moral behavior, your ethical imperative. Your leadership is based upon knowledge, research, an openness to public discourse and criticism. That's modern leadership. A leadership, you know, unlike, and I have to say this, unlike a Al Sharpton, who has literally become an attack dog for the Obama administration. And of course, you mentioned the NAACP. I mean, it is embarrassing. It is embarrassing. And let's be real. Take Al Sharpton. Al Sharpton is not even a liberal. He is a neoliberal. His alliances with Bloomberg, his alliances with Newt Gingrich, his alliance with the Obama and apology for the Obama administration puts him in the camp of neoliberalism. Who are other neoliberals? I mean, neoliberals run the Democratic Party, and neoliberalism is at odds with the interests of African Americans.
Certainly, we need the benefits of science to understand the cataclysmic collapse of a centuries-old economic system.
That's right. But see, there's this kind of unwritten code where black people don't get into foreign policy or economic matters. That's the white thing. And so black intellectuals and black leaders, when they talk about the economy, it's all about complaints. Yeah, we need to complain and protest, but we need to have an analysis of the economy, an analysis of the way out of the crisis, pardon me, the crisis of the economy. They don't do it. You know, it's just like when Jealous and Muriel and Al Sharpton went to the White House. Tavis Smiley was right. What did they go there with and what did they come out with? Nothing.
Professor Anthony Montero of Temple University.
A local Muslim group's effort to establish a community center in downtown Manhattan has been catapulted into a huge national controversy and possibly even an election year issue. We spoke with Black Agenda Report senior columnist Margaret Kimberly.
Well, first of all, there is no mosque. the Cordoba Initiative is planning to build a cultural center. We should think of it the way we would think of the YMCA or YMHA. There will be prayer rooms in this building, but it, first of all, is not a mosque. Secondly, and if it were a mosque, even if it were, so what? To say that there is some radius around the World Trade Center site within which Muslim religion cannot be celebrated is discriminatory and bigoted, and of course it is racist since Muslims are almost all people of color.
Well, is that, in fact, the heart of the matter?
Oh, of course it is. There are, even though this non-mosque is being called a mosque, there have been protests all around the country regarding the building or expansions of mosques. There was one in Staten Island that was planned in Staten Island just a few months ago. The Archdiocese of New York had planned to sell an abandoned convent to a Muslim congregation, and there was an uproar about it. People claimed the issue was parking and traffic and so forth, but they reneged on their agreement and ended up not selling the property. It wasn't near Ground Zero. So the excuse was racism, which has been legitimized in the eyes of many people by 9/11. So people say, well, I'm not against Muslims, I'm just against terrorism, smearing all Muslims as terrorists. It's interesting, though, that that doesn't happen when the perpetrators of crimes are white Americans and Europeans. We can go back through history and talk about numerous atrocities, cases of genocide, extermination, slavery, and the people who perpetrated these acts were not characterized by, every member of those groups were not characterized by those acts.
Some of us found it amazing how quickly this became a national issue.
Yes, it did. It was partly political. It's an election year. There are congressional elections all over the country, so that candidates in Nevada or Alaska or Iowa or California feel that they can weigh in on a local New York City issue, and with effect. Unfortunately, I have to say they may be right. There are enough people who are that racist and that stupid that they will vote for or against a certain person or party based on the position they take about whether or not a Muslim group can build an interfaith cultural center near the old World Trade Center site.
And if they can't build there, where else can they not build?
Well, apparently not anywhere. People are finding, well, some people actually are very blatant. They don't want Muslims around. They fear Muslims. They hate Muslims and don't want them in their towns or cities. Some people are that open. Others say that all Muslims are terrorists and that they have reason to fear them. But really, it's about isolating a group of people to such an extent that they cannot act publicly, they can't worship in public, they can't identify themselves as Muslims, and they become more and more marginalized in society. So that is definitely the goal of many of these people, to marginalize people of color, and it's easy to beat up this particular people and blame all of them for this act which took place in 2001, and start with them, but then extend it to others. So not only do we have claimed fears of terrorism, but a fear of terror babies, getting rid of the, or changing the 14th Amendment to not give automatic citizenship to anyone born here. We are to fear Mexican anchor babies and fear terror baby terrorists, or we're told, members of Congress have said this, that people come here to the United States to drop babies. I believe Lindsey Graham used those words. The way you talk about an animal and not a human being, to get the rights of American citizenship and to grow up and become terrorists.
It does appear that some white people are very anxious about their status in the United States.
Well, they are. They always are. I think it puts black people in a particularly precarious position. Much of this has come about as a result of the election of a black president. who nevertheless does not defend us and our interests. So here we have the elected, the elevation of this man, which has sparked this fear, which will come back to haunt us, but the man whose presence has created this situation won't lift a finger to help us. So it's a particularly dangerous time for us. And all of these groups, you know, Mexican babies or praying Muslims, I think it would be wise for black people to see themselves among these groups. You know, you start with people who are undocumented or Muslims praying in a certain location. And then, of course, it will obviously and inevitably mean that we will be marginalized more so as well.
Were you surprised by the strong position taken by your billionaire mayor, who is Jewish, Michael Bloomberg?
I am, you know, I generally have nothing good to say about Mayor Bloomberg, but he is alone in standing by his position that he is in favor of the center being built. Others have equivocated, made very mild statements that, you know, you have the right to build a house of worship anywhere you'd like. But he is alone among New York politicians in really being forthright in of the most prominent politicians in his support of this center. The governor keeps saying it's kind of comical that he has negotiations going on. The state will help this group find another location, although the group insists that they have no intention of looking elsewhere. And some people should be very embarrassed. I was very disheartened about Howard Dean's comments. And in the days when I still thought there was hope for the Democratic Party, I liked Howard Dean a lot, but he wasn't even paying attention. He kept referring to the mosque that's not a mosque. He implied that even Muslims didn't want the center being built. He said it was insensitive. That's the language that many people use for the center to be located near the World Trade Center. Today he modified his comments somewhat and said he was in favor of a compromise, but why is there a need for any sort of compromise? This group has every right to, they've passed all the laws, all the ordinances, everything that you would need in New York City in order to purchase and build on property they have complied with, and that should be the only issue. It doesn't matter, frankly, that other people don't like it. It doesn't matter that their polls showing the majority of people are against it. That is not the point. But this has been a particularly ugly time. And, of course, we have to mention the president and his unhelpful comments. He said, as far as his apologists are trying to, as always, cover for him, but he seemed to be, to me, quite clear in saying that the group could build on that site. Less than 24 hours later, he said, well, I'm not saying it has to be there. I'm just saying they have a right to do it. He definitely backtracked and, frankly, made the situation worse. I didn't expect the president to weigh in, but if he was going to and if he couldn't be on the right side, he should not have bothered if he couldn't do that.
Regular public school classes will resume in a few weeks, with teachers facing unprecedented job insecurity and new threats from the Obama administration. President Obama's so-called Race to the Top program seeks to weaken teachers' unions and punish teachers whose students do poorly on standardized tests. Daniel Weil is an activist and writer on education and labor issues. He spoke recently with Solomon Kamasong of Your World News.
The issue now with Race to the Top is basically it's an extortion racket. Now, what Arne Duncan has managed to do is what George W. Bush could never have done in his wildest wet dreams, and that is to actually destroy public education city by city, state by state under the auspices that he's helping children because the big bad teachers unions are standing in the way and he's out for educational reform. Every time you hear on the corporate media the word reform, I'll put the word D in front of it and take the R out. It's deform. What the race to the top is the following. He gets into office, Obama appoints him, and they come up, they hatch a plan, but it's not they that hatch it. The plan's hatched with Wall Street investors, of course, who control the Obama administration from Goldman Sachs on down to J.P. Morgan, the whole bloody rotten mess of them, begin to sit down and say, okay, based on what we've been able to do in New Orleans and based on what we've been able to do in Chicago, how can we go about privatizing the entire system in the United States through charter schools and through privatization schemes. And what they came up with was a fancy name, Race to the Top, which, as you note, exhibits in its naked form the whole insidious nature of competition when education itself is a collaborative project. It has nothing to do with competing. People collaborate in education. Dialogue means two people speaking. Dia means two. So no, it's not monologue. Monologue would be competition. All right, how can we go about privatizing it all? Well, these cities are cash-strapped. They don't have any money. The economic crisis these people knew about way back in 2005. They were just waiting for the bubble to burst in 2008. We all predicted it way back in 2005. I'm sure you did, and I know others did. Anyway, they said, well, these cities are broke. They're busted. They're not going to get any money. It's all going to war. We've got $2 trillion shooting out at war. The military-industrial complex owns this country. And therefore, how can we go now? Can we take over these cities and take over their educational systems? Well, here's one way we could do it. Let's take $4.3 billion in cash and put it in a purse, and then we'll go over to a city, let's say like New York or New Jersey. We'll go over to a state like New Jersey, and we'll say to New Jersey, we'll say, like, look, we know your schools are failing. And we know that you can't even keep your lunch programs going, nor can you have after school programs. Your buses are old bluebirds that are broken. You can't even keep your people hired or fed. Okay, you've been starved by a tax bleeding, drowning government in a bathtub type of thing. And so as a result, we've got a deal for you. We've got $4.3 billion in cash. We'll give you hundreds of millions of dollars each state if you agree to what's called Race to the Top. Our four assurances have to be agreed to. Well, what are the four assurances under Race to the Top? Number one, you have to agree to standardized testing, and that testing has to be a panoptic type of testing that starts with a child at 3 to 5 years old and follows the child up until their graduation. You've got to become part of a testing regime. These testing regimes will be run by private companies. Bill Bennett runs one with a former junk bond manager, Michael Milken. And Kaplan University runs testing prep and testing programs. So you're going to now have to test all your children all day long, every day, because we want to see who's passing standardized tests. The second thing you're going to need to do is you're going to need to get rid of merit. You're going to need to accept merit pay. Your unions are going to have to begin to start breaking apart. They haven't been functioning. You've got to get rid of tenure. Their argument is we can't fire bad teachers, which is absolutely a lie. Any principal can write up a bad teacher and fire a bad teacher. That's the principals are lazy or they don't want the political problems to come with it. That's why they don't do it. But they've brokered a lie to the American people that you can't fire a bad teacher, which is absolutely not true. Of course you can. You can fire them within 6 months if you want to. But the bottom line is you've got to agree to merit pay, give up tenure, give up seniority rights, in some cases give up collective bargaining in its entirety. You then have to agree to the third assurance, and the third assurance is that there's no caps on charter schools, that you remove any state caps you have on charter schools so that now we can run unbridled across your geographical landscape with as many of these boutique, phony little charter schools or the more insidious ones the ones I call the retail charter chains, which run like Walmart and are aimed at urban communities, where youth are to be put on a conveyor belt of despair and worked on by privatizers until they either end up in prison, foster homes, on the street, gangs, or under some kind of containment. So you're going to have to agree to lifting caps on charter schools. Now you're going to also have to agree to allowing privatizers to come in, what they call turnaround artists, and run these charter schools. We're no longer going to come from a pool of principals. We have the Eli Broad Foundation, which trains our managers. All the verbiage changed. So now a teacher is an associate, like at Walmart, instead of a worker. See, they have to change the language that you're either a team player or a team member or a crew member. Everything sounds collaborative, associate, team member, crew member, but everything is absolutely competitive. So it's all hidden behind rhetoric of mendacity, I mean, just absolute lies. So collaborative language used to mask competitive and ruthless policies. You agree to this, and you agree to putting in mayoral control where we get rid of school boards completely, and we've got some money for you. Now, if you don't agree to that, then we don't have any money for you, and neither does the federal government. This is the only money available. So it's a form of extortion. And then you have these schools that are just in horrendous situations that are just falling apart, haven't been fixed for decades. The bathrooms, toilets don't work. The pencils break in the pencil sharpeners. The textbooks are 10 years old. The schools are sitting there saying, well, we need some of this money. And the teachers are saying, well, wait a minute, hold on. In order to get this, you're going to decimate us as workers. We know more about your kids than these privatizers do. Let us work with the community in the cities. And we'll. But the problem is under capitalism right now, there is no money, Solomon. There is no money for the public. This country is dead broke. It's bankrupt. It's bankrupted its country through militarism. And as a result, Arne Duncan now has a bag full of money, and he goes state by state, and he says, did you agree to what I said? Yeah, you did. Let me check it out. Let me see your books. He takes a look at him. He puts stacks of cash on the table like Al Capone used to do from the city that he's from, and he moves on to the next state. And if you didn't agree to it, like Detroit, for example, that wouldn't agree to it last week, he says, you're not getting any Race to the Top money. Well, what does that mean? That means Detroit doesn't have any money. None. None whatsoever.
That was Danny Wild speaking with Solomon Kamensong on the neoliberal war on public education.
Big things may soon be happening in government policy on housing, but not necessarily good things. The Obama administration recently held a conference on the future of housing finance, but neglected to invite anyone representing tenants, consumers, or community groups. Wall Street, however, was there in strength. We spoke with Eileen Markey, contributing editor to the New York public interest publication City Limits.
It's certainly true that the usual suspects from CRA reform were not there, and so we didn't see those kind of grassroots people that we're used to looking to, at least in the New York area, when we talk about housing and when we talk about the problems that housing finance. The changes in housing finance over the last decade have caused. I think it's always good to remember that it was the Acorns and the small nonprofits that 5-10 years ago were talking about predatory lending and ringing the warning bell, saying that subprime lending was going to explode and that it was endangering our neighborhoods and it was endangering whole communities. It's always important, you know, when the big shots talk about we never could have seen this whole housing bust coming, to say, well, actually, a lot of people who work in church basements and small little nonprofits have been warning about it for a decade. So I suppose in the idea that maybe the people on the street are the greatest experts and they weren't there, that is a problem. On the other hand, I've read, I saw your commentary, and there was something in Salon as well talking about the lack of affordable housing advocates there. While it's certainly true that there weren't the real grassroots activist people there, there was the Urban Institute, and there was there were people from Furman Center for Public Policy, for Real Estate and Public Policy here in New York, which does incredible work really kind of providing the ammunition, the data and the research for affordable housing advocacy and policy. And there's also Alan Seidman, who used to be with the New America Foundation, who I think is working on like the community reinvestment end of a bank now, but certainly comes out of advocating for affordable housing and a career financing affordable housing. So.
Well, we're familiar with the Urban Institute and their efforts to downsize New Orleans. And the New America Institute often acts as an adjunct of the Obama administration these days.
True, right, right. They're certainly friendly to the Obama administration.
But those who were certainly there were Wells Fargo and the Bank of America and even ratings folks from Moody's. Doesn't that tend to say that this was a conference on banking and housing in America?
It certainly was. It certainly was absolutely a conference on housing finance and how to figure out changes or reforms to how it is that we come up with the financing for housing. And that doesn't mean that the jobs that you and I have to afford our mortgages or our rent, but the ways in which mortgages are underwritten and sold. So it wasn't a conference on on how best to site affordable housing or how best to run housing, but it indeed was a banking conference on housing. And your point is, is certainly well taken that that there were plenty of banks there. And then if you want to say the more the organizations that might be considered to have more of a focus on affordable housing and on economic justice issues were certainly liberal as opposed to radical, if you don't want to call them liberal, but they certainly were, pretty mainstream, that sort of line of thinking. Whether it's Furman, who, does, I think, amazing work, or whether it's the New American Foundation, but certainly, New York Communities for Change was not there. And it's a major oversight, obviously, that leaders in the Community Reinvestment Act movement were not there, since they're the ones who, really sounded the warning bell about all this and know firsthand and through a lot of really activist research.
The Obama administration is making noises as if they're on the verge of a paradigm shift in federal housing policy. What's your reading on that?
Two readings, I suppose. They're certainly on the verge of or in the midst of a paradigm shift when it comes to their public housing policy. The significance of TETRA, which is an act having to do with public housing, things like NYCHA, just can't be overstated. I mean, it's absolutely groundbreaking, huge. I'm a reporter, so I'm not going to say whether it's good or bad, but it's tremendous. And I'm not sure that people quite realize the extent of that. Basically, what it calls for is a wholesale overhaul of how we look at public housing so that it will be less and less something that is supported by tax dollars and more something that uses the private market, that uses investment, private investors to raise money to pay for public housing, big public housing developments, which is dramatically different and, to my eyes, a curious response to or curious policy to come out just a few years after we've seen the way that the private financial market has ravaged homeownership. So then invite those forces into public housing seems rash at best. So certainly the Obama administration is in the midst of an absolutely huge rewriting of how we deal with public housing. And I think this is something that began in a lot of ways at several administrations ago with Hope 6, which your listeners are familiar with from other parts of the country, where and many of the New Jersey cities where federal dollars were used to knock down large public housing developments with the idea that then smaller, in some cases owner-occupied units would be built, and there have been many problems with that, the biggest one being that the replacement housing has not kept pace with the number of units that were destroyed when you knocked down big towers. But I think that whole idea of we don't use the government to house the poorest people has been creeping in since Clinton. And obviously the Bush administration's supported that as well. And so in a sense, Obama's going far further in that and saying, what we need is to bring in the, like they always say, the creativity and innovation of the private marketplace to support affordable housing. Given what we've seen with what privatized market did to decent normal mortgages, that seems like a strange reaction. But there's all sorts of ins and outs associated with it. Then on the other hand, if we're talking about this housing finance conference, nothing firm came out of it. It certainly was in no way an announcement of a new policy or a new program or a new neighborhood stabilization program or anything like that, but rather a bunch of people who usually talk to each other getting together to talk to each other some more, largely about what should be done with Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac and what should be the government's role in mortgages. It seemed to range from the government should control all mortgages, should be the underwriter for all mortgages, which is what one of the investment people said, to other advocates who were there who said there should be no government involvement in underwriting mortgages, period.
We at Black Agenda Radio have our own expertise in that area. My co-host, Nellie Bailey, is also executive director of the Harlem Tenants Council. Nellie, what's your assessment of Obama's housing conference?
Well, let's start with, for sure, and in this case, the Obama administration has thumbed its nose, their nose, at a core constituent base that they have. In this case, affordable housing advocates who were excluded from this conference. But I think we need to talk about two issues that was excluded in terms of this discussion and what we need to look at in terms of this paradigm shift. First, let's take a look at the depth of the crisis that in part explains this shift in housing policy. Let's take a look at the numbers. About 1.7 million homeowners, and let's start with homeowners first before we move to public housing and Section 8 voucher holders. About 1.7 million homeowners received a foreclosure-related warning this year between January and June of 2010. This translates into 1 in 78 U.S. homes. And more than 1 million U.S. households are projected to lose their homes to foreclosures in 2010. We have to take a hard look at vulture investors honing in on the rental market, where they stand to make a bundle. Residential real estate investors are taking advantage of low acquisition prices for distressed properties that in some cases have dropped as much as 70%. In addition, rock-bottom interest rates and, most importantly, stable rental markets have become the new profit paradigm instead of buying a property, flipping it for quick cash. Rentals are now hefty and steady incomes. With a steady cash flow, there's no need to worry about price drops. Then, too, we have to remember the banks are really controlling and managing the inventory of distressed properties on the market. In a climate of rising unemployment, reduced income, a spiraling down economy, and the failure of the Obama administration's $75 billion foreclosure prevention program, bankers do not want to take on more than a million homes this year that will push down housing values. There are more than 7.3 million home loans in some stage of delinquency. For 17 months, the past 17 months in a row, home foreclosures exceeded 300,000 per month. The bankers understand that there is no profit margin in this equation. Rentals will become the shift in paradigm, as is the focus of this conference. In the past, repossession was the last stage in the foreclosure process. People could stay in their homes until the banks took possession, or they could sell their homes at auction. Now, the new paradigm is rental assistance and rental for these foreclosed properties.
Now, Nellie, Section 8 housing subsidies for the poor have always been underfunded, yet we heard nothing about Section 8 in that housing conference in Washington. What's your reaction?
We didn't and we won't. In fact, the Section 8 voucher program has been under attack from the Obama administration as it was with the Bush administration. Let's take a look at some numbers that we are dealing with here. HUD has three major rental programs that collectively provide rental subsidies to approximately 4.5 million households nationwide. The programs are the Public Housing Program, HUD Assisted Multifamily Rental Program, and the Section 8 Housing Choice Voucher Program that we have seen a reduction in the subsidy, and in some cases, such as here in New York City, where the New York City Housing Authority administers 100,000 Section 8 vouchers. But what have we seen here? A cutback and elimination of the Section 8 voucher program, including those who are handicapped, those who have been given almost without warning a notice overnight that in fact they have to leave. So if this is an indication in terms of this extraneous discussion on their intent to deal with a rental assistance program, not only for those who are facing foreclosures, but most importantly, the rental market, because the paradigm shift is to the rental market, let's take a critical look at those programs, the rental assistance programs that have been subsidized by the Obama administration.
Thank you, Nellie Bailey, my co-host and also executive director of the Harlem Tenants Council. And that's it for this edition of Black Agenda Radio. Our thanks to the good people at the Progressive Radio Network, and especially to our engineer, Caitlin Fitzgerald.
This is Black Agenda Radio, information for liberation.